Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE for this evening's event. My name is Jean-Christophe Plantin. I am assistant professor at the LSE in the Department of Media and Communication, while also the interim director for the Data and Society Master Program. It's a great honor for me to welcome Professor Kenneth Benoit here today. As I'm sure you're all aware, Ken is professor of quantitative social research methods and head of the Department of Methodology here at the LSE. I'm equally delighted to welcome Professor Sarah Hobolt, who is the Sutherland Chair in European Institutions at the European Institute, at the LSE again, and Dr. Jennifer Jackson-Priest, who is Associate Professor in Nationalism in Europe at the European Institute, again, at the LSE. This event, entitled The Brexit Debate Through Social Media, Deliberative Discussion or Deliberate Dysfunction, marks the third lecture in the 2017 series of the LSE Works. LSE Works is a series of public lectures that began in 2011 that showcase some of the latest research by LSE academics departments and research centers in an accessible manner. In each session, LSE academics will present key research findings, demonstrating, where possible, the implications of their studies for public policy. Held every 2 years, a successful second series of LSE Works was held in 2013 and continued with a third series in 2015. In 2017, LSE is delighted to continue the success of LSE Works with a full series of public lecture. The next LSE Works lecture will be held by Dr. Eleni Karagiannaki and Dr. Abigail McKnight from LSE Center for Analysis of Social Exclusion, entitled The Relationship Between Inequality and Poverty, Mechanisms and Policy Options, on Wednesday, February 8, 2017, at 6:30, here in the Hong Kong Theatre. Tonight, Professor Kenneth Benoit will demonstrate how, by using over 35 million tweets collected in the year before the Brexit referendum, he analyzes the debate and campaign through social media to track the framing, the argumentation, and the patterns of communication about the issues and consequences of the vote. So this is going to be about Twitter, but for those of you in the room using Twitter, the hashtag for tonight's event is LSEWorks, so please do tweet if you have to, but also please remember to put your phones on silent to not disrupt the event. This evening event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available soon as a podcast. For your information, as a side note, our students are collecting for RAG this week and plan to collect after the lecture tonight. We would encourage people, if they wish, to donate to the charities they are collecting, for which are Real Action, Student Mind, and Amar Foundations. So we're going to start with Ken, who's going to talk for 40 minutes. Then we're going to have the responses from Sarah and Jennifer. As usual, after the lecture, there will be the chance for you to put your questions to the panel. But for now, will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Professor Kenneth Benoit to deliver his lecture, The Brexit Debate Through Social Media, Deliberative Discussions or Deliberate Dysfunctions.
All right. Thank you very much for the introduction. I hope you can hear me. I'm not sure that this mic is on, but someone will tell me if... Do I need to turn this thing on here? It's good. All right. Okay. Well, I'm going to disappoint you. We don't have 35 million tweets to show you. We only have about 26 million. So the analysis that we did only goes up to the end of June. That probably makes no difference to you because this is a massive quantity of social media data that we analyzed. And the first thing I want to do is I'm going to tell you that unlike a lot of academic discussions that we would have about social media, about political communications, we would be talking about theories of communication, theories of behavior. I'm not going to do that tonight. So this is not about presenting to you academic theories or hypotheses that we're trying to test. This, in this project in particular, is really an exploratory study from a team and a project that I'm working on that looks at the debate over Brexit through social media, and specifically through Twitter. So this is very exploratory work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through the results that we have so far and explore this with you. And I couldn't do this without a large group of people behind this project helping me. So I want to mention, I want to mention this group because I've got a team here, first of all, in our department, the Department of Methodology, and they're fortunately, they're here tonight. So Aki Matsuo is sitting here. He helped. He's a research officer on this project, which is the EU Engage project, funded by Horizon 2020, one of those European grants that may very well be affected by Brexit. And this is a three-year project with a group from Italy where we're analyzing public engagement and elite engagement through the European arena on issues that concern them and issues of Europe. And Brexit is a perfect example of that. And we also did all of the analysis in a large R package, which is for text analysis that I've been working on another EU grant for several years. And some of the team working on that is as long as an hour ago, in fact, is sitting here. So Kohei and Hayan, sitting in the front, have been working on this with me, along with some others. And then we also have some colleagues at Imperial College London, Julio, David Birch, who sent me some screen captures from the Data Observatory at the Data Science Institute I'm going to show you. I wish we could have a facility like that here. We don't. We just have these traditional screens. And then Mark Kennedy is supervising them over there. And this is also partly sponsored by the Social and Economic Data Science Unit, which is a departmental research unit in my department, where we're doing and greatly expanding our activities in the field of data science, including starting a master's program in 18 months' time, and cooperating with the Department of Statistics, who's starting a master's program in MSc in data science from September. Social media is an important part of political communication. You couldn't not get this fact unless you have not looked at any sort of media surrounding the new president of the United States inaugurated on Friday. And the news that his communications through this platform tends to make in its own right. Twitter is a microblogging platform for social media that is entirely public and generates an enormous quantity of data. And this data is in the volume of over 400 million tweets are sent worldwide per day. These tweets have the 160-character message that you're familiar with reading, but they also have a lot more information. And when we download these from a platform that gives us all this data, it comes with about 40 times more information than the actual 160 characters themselves. There's a lot of metadata about the user, the characteristics of the user, sometimes the location of the user, information about the language that's added by Twitter, and a whole host of other identification data that is useful for analysis. In the United States, despite all the attention to Twitter and Donald Trump's followers, only less than 30% of the population are actually active users of Twitter. That is a figure that is about 20% in the United Kingdom, which is still sizable, but only 20% of the population, or 13.1 million in 2016, were active on this platform. If we were to look at a previous election, the figures wouldn't be this high, but it turns out that 563 members of parliament out of 650 have Twitter accounts. You can find this information. It's 87% of UK MPs have Twitter accounts. You can find this information by going to just Google UK MPs on Twitter. There are numerous pages which not only have their Twitter accounts, but also have some analysis, the latest tweets, topics, proportions of parties. You can see how each party is doing. 100% of the UK Independence Party, for example, has Twitter account. Who could that be? You have archives of the tweets. So this is very public information. Twitter accounts are preserved, by the way. So President Obama had the account POTUS for President of the United States, or POTUS. And this account has now gone to Donald Trump. God help it. And Obama's tweets are now archived under POTUS44, and these are part of the historical archive. There are also platforms that capture every tweet for the historical record, even if a user goes on to delete a tweet, as has been known to happen. So how is Twitter used for political communication? If you're not familiar with this platform, you probably are, it can be used to send a message. So here's a tweet from Boris Johnson where he's sending a message about what he thinks about the next leader of the World Health Organization. Here's a tweet from President Trump saying that 15 hours ago is the big day they're going to start building the wall. You can use Twitter to call attention to an event, in this case, a report. So here is a tweet which was retweeted, I'll talk more about those in a moment, by Nigel Farage. This is about a deal that was reported on Sky News. You can take something and you can broadcast that out to your followers, who then can retweet it again. And there are accounts down here, 1.2 thousand people, 1,200 people liked this, 571 have retweeted it. You can mention other people. This is something we'll be using in our analysis. So in this case, Michael Gove is a user, but he was mentioned in someone else's tweet. And it turns out whom you mention, it makes it easy to predict which side of the Brexit debate you're on, among other things. And the Times was also mentioned in this tweet. There are also hashtags. Hashtags are very important because out of all the things you can say and all the ways that you could say them, when you analyze language, especially when it's Twitter, you're trying to be as brief as possible. So you're using the numeral 2 instead of TO to save a character. You're using abbreviations. You're using acronyms. But hashtags are like hyperlinks in a tweet that provide some reference. In fact, they are hyperlinked when you read tweets. And if we looked at a hashtag like Brexit, which is one of the search terms we use for capturing all this information, that would be a shortcut for mentioning some label. There are also retweets. Here's a retweet from Trump. You can take something, in this case, President Trump from the account retweeted the personal Donald Trump. And retweets, turns out we're going to look at retweet networks, and that's going to be indicative of different communities that illustrate the people who are communicating and retweeting within the Leave camp and the Remain camp. So for this project, it's true that for basically the calendar year, I think we captured somewhere between 35 and 39 million tweets. The present analysis that we're going to be showing you is basically January through June. And we captured this based on search terms. So we have a platform that is capturing these search terms based on the term Brexit is the single most important search term, but also on these hashtags and on these user accounts. And we adjusted these slightly throughout the sample, but this was pretty sufficient to pick up things that were related to the UK's referendum on whether or not to remain in the European Union. And there's a capture platform that we use. It's by a company called Vigiglobe, or Whizzer. A lot of people ask me, how do you get so many tweets? Well, we're part of a large grant team, and there's a team in Brussels who has money from this grant to pay for access to a company which has access to what's called the Twitter Firehose, which basically captures these tweets in real time. And they have a little analytics platform like this, and you can see some things, but it's not actually very useful. So this is a company whose value added is supposedly to classify these things, like the gender of the tweeter. According to them, 70% male. We don't believe that. And over here, apparently, it's 47% negative versus only 8% positive. And we don't believe that either, because their definition of sentiment is different from what we found. And I'm going to show you those results, too. So this is the sort of thing that we have the technology to do better rather than take from their platform. So we're not using this. We're just getting the raw data from them. So let me show you some raw data, and this is where I'm going to basically walk you through the pictures and show you what we found. So this is a plot of the volume of tweets for two different categories of tweets. So there are tweets where you send a message, sort of an original type of message, and you can also share things that you've posted. I think the shares are when you send out a mention or a like of a page, like when you retweet or send a link to Sky News or maybe this talk, for example. And then a post is when you send out a positive message, like tomorrow we're going to build a nice back room, nice garden shed or something, maybe a wall. And then you have this volume over time, which shows this is on what's called a logarithmic scale. So 1 times this 1e plus 0.4 basically means a 1 with 4 zeros. So that's 10,000 tweets. Up here, we're talking about a million tweets. So as this thing goes up, we're getting an exponential increase in the volume. So this is not double what this was over here. It's 10 to the 2. It's 100 times more. Over here, we have a huge spike in June. So the vast majority of tweets about Brexit peaked in June. Huge, huge spike all the way up to the referendum. And it's gone down since then, but you can see events. So you can use Twitter for event detection, which is one of the things that the guys at Imperial are doing. There are 3.6 million unique users. And what we did actually in most of our analysis was to collapse the data where we aggregated the tweets by each user. So we're not actually analyzing all these as separate tweets. We're analyzing them by user. The average user sent about 7 tweets, 7.2. The median user only sent a single tweet. So as an average, this central tendency is inflated by the really high volume of tweeters. And apparently the maximum tweeter sent 81,000 tweets. Aki, that's incredible. Is that a bot? It's a bot. So some of these things are basically computer programs whose job it is to send out high quantities of tweets. I'm glad that's a bot. We wouldn't want that to be. These are some of the what we call heavy users. So these are users who have posted a lot of either main shares or posts. You can see that these are bots up here. I vote leave, I vote stay are what we call bots. There's the 81,000. And this is something whose job it is to, based on some filtering, to rebroadcast information, shares, you know, fake news, that sort of thing. And then we have users who are genuinely sending a very large number of original tweets. You know, 20,000 for Brexit March, it's a very large volume. If you want to explore these, and I think these slides will be available somewhere, we've set up some interactive pages where if you click on this and you get a web browser, which is what just happened here, then you can actually go through this and you can explore. So these are live on the internet from our analysis. So you can see that the very top tag is something that was a key search term, which is Brexit, EU ref. But you could also see that vote leave, for example, was the third most popular hashtag. Stronger in is only fourth. This is what we call a neutral one. That's a neutral one. That's a neutral one. Vote leave is clearly someone who supports the leave side. And remain, vote remain, and you can explore these. But it's interesting when you get down to some of the lower ones, there are some interesting ones in there. Boris Johnson is a user, but he's also a hashtag. There's a Nexit. I'm not going to walk through all of these, but I will leave that if something you want to explore. There's also a list of mentions, which you can look at, that we've plotted. We've listed the first 10,000 mentions. Let's look at some of these graphically. So this is a type of plot called a word cloud. This plots the main hashtags as a series of terms that whose size is proportional to their frequency. So we've taken out the Brexit one, otherwise everything looks small relative to it. But vote leave, very, very big hashtag. Stronger in is not nearly as strong. And you can see that these are terms that when you take out all the language and you just look at these links, you can see that these are terms related to the debate. And how people use these, as it turns out, is going to be very useful in predicting which side they're on. Because we're going to do a bit of machine learning on a small set of tweets, and then we're going to be able to predict for the rest of those millions of users which side they're on. In fact, I'm going to show you predictions on some people that are here in this room as to what side they're on using our machine learning. If we look at the evolutions of these hashtags, we can see that this is a ranking scale. So we're plotting basically the top, I think it's the top 10 hashtags, and the rankings all the way across the top, number one, the unchallenged number one is Brexit. Actually, it goes to number two for one little blip there. And the rest of these are rankings of the terms. And you can see that the remain was actually very low on the list. It didn't even really show up in the rankings until somewhere around March, and then it went to the top. Hashtags evolve over time. And it's a really interesting issue as to what the life cycle of a hashtag is, what the attention cycle is. That's something I'll leave to our friends in media and communications. But by looking at these and what they are, we do see something about the substance. You can see that UKIP here, this hashtag for UKIP, took quite a drop in July after the June. So we do have these through July. It's not just June. Yeah, they took a drop there in the month after. If we look at the daily ranking of hashtags, these are daily rankings of surging popularity. So these are some that are lower in the rankings but have gotten higher. We can see in a little bit more resolution. So if we look, for example, at bromane, which is a hashtag here in this sort of darker blue, we can see that it's basically moving up. It came into parlance. People weren't really talking about it. Someone coined the term. You can see how these things evolve. That's not going to tell us basically which side was winning. So this is not necessarily representative. It's more just an evolution of some labels that people are using. So interesting bits from this are, what can we use about this information more systematically that tells us the patterns of language that one side is using versus another? How can we use our information about these patterns of language to understand which side a particular user is on? This is a very typical example where machine learning helps us a lot, because machine learning allows us to pick up the patterns from a small set that we can get our hands on and come to grips with, and then project that onto these millions and millions of tweets that are just too vast, even for armies of graduate students over the summer to spend time coding. So we used a machine learning method called a naive Bayes classifier as our main classifier. And we also compared this to results from another supervised machine learning method known as support vector machines. The data source was to combine all the tweets at the user level, and then we created some training data from this. We selected some power users. We took a set of leave and remain hashtags that were very clearly leave and remain, so we don't have to predict that leave EU is a leave hashtag. We know that. We use that for training information. And we did a prediction from this. We looked at the differences in the usages of these and then the probabilistic classification, and we took the people that were basically in the bottom and top 20.2 of the probability of being a leave or remain, and we use those to classify them. And when we say this bag of words method, we basically looked at the individual terms in people's tweets, including usernames and hashtags. So we evaluated this model. Basically, we ran three different models, and it turns out when you use hashtags and mentions together, you get the highest predictive accuracy, which was close to 90%. So what results do we get from this? Well, the first thing is that there were more remain users and tweets than there were leave tweets on balance. That it wasn't huge, but it was about 37% to 34% over the period that we examined. And then there was this large group, largely split of almost a third of what we called neutral tweets. They were tweets that weren't clearly pro or remain. And if we look at the evolution of these, we actually see from this that the side for remain and the side for leave, overall, you end up with them tracking one another pretty closely. But here it looks like the remain is below the leave. So did we transpose that?
No, it's just like there's a huge volume of remain tweets on the day of the spike.
So we have a huge, that's right, there's a huge spike here, and this is a logarithmic scale. So that's basically 10 times the tweets of the leave. And that really skews the results. That's one of the reasons you have to interpret these logarithmic scales. You can't necessarily visually average across them. But they're tracking rather closely. And you know, if you were to think from this that the leave side was going to win, you wouldn't have been totally off. But on the day of the election, there was a surge in remain. So we used this prediction to predict these MPs that have these accounts, these 500-plus MPs that have accounts. If we take this and we map this onto their users, their combined tweets, and we do the prediction, this is what we end up with. So basically, if you're blue, you're leave, and if you're red, you remain. Labor, it looks, from our prediction, very strongly remain. Conservatives are split, but there were more remain than any other camp. Greens, independents, remain. Democratic Unionist Party was mostly Leave. The UK Independence Party, we would be very surprised. There'd be something wrong with our algorithm if they weren't predicted to leave. Sinn Féin, largely neutral. And the Scottish parties wanted to remain. So this is very good classification task for looking at these MPs. And none of these people's tweets were used to fit this model. They were just in the out of sample set. If we look at some specific accounts from a few well-known Twitter users, then this is actually a projection of these users on the probability of remain scale, where most of the LSE accounts, like LSE Brexit vote, are very pro-remain. We can see Sarah there, very pro-remain, and I'm actually there. I don't have nearly as many as Sarah or Simon Hicks, for example, but we're all very pro-remain from the language. There was one account that puzzled us because we looked for all the user accounts that had things like LSE in them, and then this one came up, and I thought, LSE Eckford, what is that? Is that an LSE account? I looked this person up, and actually it's not. So this is someone named Linda Siegford. The nice thing about Twitter, because it's all public, I'm not showing you anything that's in any way restricted. This is clearly someone who is an outspoken conservative. Wants mass impeachment for the Democrats. Unfortunately, you can only impeach the president. I don't think you can impeach congresspeople. But anyway, so that wasn't an LSE account. If we partition the hashtags that were used as part of this prediction to sort of see which types of information was most predictive of a side, we can do this thing, which is a partitioned word cloud, and we can look at the remain vote, the leave vote, the neutral vote hashtags, and very clearly we can see that the hashtags for leave are all over where they should be, the hashtags for staying in. Very interesting, the UKIP as a hashtag is actually a remain. It's in the remain language. Not because maybe people were criticizing UKIP or maybe this was not a reference of support. Not necessarily what you would think. David Cameron referred to in the leave. So some of these are overtly message-oriented hashtags. So if you use the hashtag LeaveEU, you're usually supporting that position. It's not obvious why the UKIP hashtag is a remain, but it was predictive of remain and very common, very, very high frequency hashtag. We've put some of these features here, so once again, you can go to a page and you can browse these yourself. If you click, for example, on this, you can sort this by the leave side and you can look at their frequencies and examine what these are, just because I knew that I didn't want to walk you through page after page of this. There's some, when we use the content of the hashtags to basically predict the cases that as content were predictive, not as users, as accounts, earlier I was predicting what these users, which side the users were on. This is using these as features of the language that were part of the prediction. Then we can see that even so, for example, the user account Sarah Holbold was as a term in other people's tweets, was strongly predictive of remain, and so were most of these LSE terms. The LSE Brexit vote as a hashtag was too, and just the LSE in general was very much more on the remain side. Interestingly, David Cameron was more towards the leave side, but still in the middle. So these are all these tags, mentions of Cameron or Cameron as a hashtag. And the color differences are not leave and remain. These color differences, we simply wrote the red, the users are red, and the hashtags in here are blue. Here are the tweets about Boris Johnson, and a bit like Boris Johnson himself, at least at various periods, he's a bit all over the place. even though we know his position in the end on Brexit very clearly, very high volume for mentions of his actual user account, because this is the count frequency on the y-axis. And this is also on a logarithmic scale, so this is 100 here and that's 10,000 there. But as a hashtag, it was basically used all over the place. Michael Gove, also a bit scattered there, but his more on the balance of on the high frequency one, slightly on the leave side, this simple Gove, slightly on the remain side. Not always clear from these whether people are criticizing a user or whether they're saying something supportive. Nigel Farage, interestingly, was the same way, although for the mentions of him as a user, this is not his prediction as a user. We already did that. We know that he's very strongly leave. But in terms of mentioning him, you can see that it was also a bit mixed. Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May. This is a bit like Theresa May. She was somewhere in the middle, but she claimed that initially she was pro-Remain, but not super strongly Remain. And a lot of the mentions since then, or more, some of these negative ones, never May, no way May, never there a May. These are pro-leave. We did a bit of mapping of this too. So we get some information from the Twitter data about geolocation of the tweets, but there's not actually much. So most tweets do not have this tag that your phone can send about exactly where you are because most people have it turned off. But we do have information about the geographic location of whatever internet access provider they used, which is close to basically their location. We plotted, once again, the blue is the remain, and the red is the blue is leave, and the red is remain. You can see that the concentrations of the pro-remain side are in Northern Ireland and in Scotland, and then the concentration here of the leave side is more in England and Wales. We got some classifications. So these were done by Julio, who is on the imperial side. He used his support vector machine classifier also to show a bit of the distribution of tweets across the rest of Europe. And these yellow dots indicate a cluster of tweets that were primarily on the Remain side. There's a lot of tweets, of course, on the British Isles there, but they're all over Europe. If you look at the corresponding classification and location for the Leave side, it's not surprisingly very confined to the British Isles. And this shouldn't be considered a comparison of volume, but you didn't see much of the pro-leave side outside of Britain. We did an analysis which I realize will be hard to see and hard to interpret, but we're working on this more now. This is a network analysis of the co-occurrence of hashtags. So if you use one hashtag, how do you connect with other hashtags through your usage? Which hashtags co-occur? The ones that are right in the middle are the highest frequency ones, the neutral ones, like Brexit, EU ref, referendum, and the ones that are the leave ones, remember, are coded in blue, and the remain are coded in red, and you can see, it's hard to see the connections, but you can see some of them. To make this a little bit more clear, we have looked at, our main goal in this was to look at some of the connections between hashtags to find out whether there was communication between the leave and remain sides through this usage of language. It's kind of hard to tell from that, so what we did was we zoomed in on some of the sides. This is the hashtag of leave networks. You can see, for example, we said that David Cameron was used more on the leave side. You can see that his use there is connected to which other terms. You can see how these things are used in terms of the strength of their connection, which is the weighted edge, the thickness of this line and its connection to others. We can zoom in a little bit more. So this is, for example, the types of connections about this hashtag LeaveEU and what some of its closest ties were. We can look at this about networks of terms that are related to leaving the EU. This is short for Brexit the movie, which is a movie pro-Brexit video that someone made. And you can also see that people are talking about Frexit and Dexit and Nexit and Grexit. And these are various forms that are closely connected to the Brexit core of the pro-leave networks of hashtags. We can look at some of the leaders in this debate. We can look at David Cameron and his connection to Sky News and the ITV and some of the other networks of people who are talking about leaving, like Baroness Warsi. If we look at the same thing, zooming in for some of the Remain networks, then here is a network of terms related to concerns about economics, for example. They're concerned about trading, gold, the pound, foreign exchange, recession. Very strong link between the trading hashtag and foreign exchange. We can see hashtag networks about certain political figures, like relationships between UKIP and the Tories, the Lib Dems, Farage, that sort of thing. Some of the really interesting analysis, so you can see that there's a challenge just to get your head around these tweets because of the density of these Twitter networks makes it look like some giant steel wool ball. They're doing some amazing work over at the Data Observatory at Imperial College London, a group that we've worked with, and these are some results provided to me by David Birch, who we'll see actually in some pictures in a moment. They have this thing that they've built called the Twitter Observatory, and they have they have this thing called the Data Observatory, which is this 270-degree series of 64 screens that you can go inside and you can see interactive visualizations of networks. And it's this immersive environment for visualizing data, and I would really love for us to have one. So if you're interested in funding such a project, please speak to me afterwards. They have 132 million pixels, so they can display a huge amount of data in high resolution. Look something like this. There's a picture of David with his master iPad thing to control this whole system. But they have these different panels where you can see the sorts of information that I've been showing you, where you have the most mentioned hashtags, the most frequently tweeting users, you have time trends, volume trends, most original tweets, that sort of thing. Interestingly, for the network purpose, when you are able to zoom out, like you're looking at the Milky Way galaxy from a little bit further away, we can color code some of the classification of tweets that are remain and some of them that are leave. And one of the things that this really zoomed out network analysis does in the data observatory is to show that there appear to be, if you were thinking about this in media terms, of an echo chamber. Are we only talking to our side? Which appears to be a feature of the Brexit campaign and of the U.S. election, for example, they found that there are several communities of leavers, but there's only one really strong Remain community. And they also found that these two communities didn't overlap very much. The evidence seems to be that these sides are talking to one and within themselves, but not across themselves. So the last thing I'm going to show you, and I'm just going to stop abruptly after the last bit of analysis on this, we did something called sentiment analysis, and this is one of my specialisms as a researcher in dealing with text analysis and text mining. And this is what we built this tool Quantita for, which stands for the Quantitative Analysis of Textual Data. Sentiment analysis is designed to extract information from the text itself and to classify basically things like positive, negative sentiment, or in the case that I'm going to show you, not only that, but also these categories about different types of language, like whether they talked about power, or whether they talked about sadness, or whether they looked to the past or the future. And, for example, to give you an idea, this is from the dictionary of this linguistic inquiry and word count, which was created by psychologists. This is a list of patterns. They're not actually terms, but they're patterns, so there are some wildcard characters with this star. These are terms that are indicative, according to these psychologists, of language about reward. So if you frame the debate in terms of reward, you'd be talking about the positive things that you expect to happen for the outcome that you're advocating. The alternative, of course, would be to talk about the disaster that will happen if the outcome that you're against would happen. And we're going to see that there are two very different approaches to this, depending on whether you're on the leave side or the remain side. So here's a plot of the relative frequency across all tweets, for example, for the reward language versus, and this is relative frequencies, so this is a proportion of all language. It's very small, but you can still look at relative differences. The leave side was using more reward language than either the neutral or the remain side. They were talking in the language of reward. If we look at a ratio of positive to negative emotional language, we can also see that the leave side was talking in more positive terms. The balance of their positive terms versus their negative terms was, in this case, about, I think, about 15 to 20% higher than it was for the remain side. So they're talking more in the language of the reward and more in the language of positive things. Sad language, on the other hand, was very largely part of the discourse of the remain side. They were talking about how sad and how bad it would be. This is the opposite of reward, about the dire and negative consequences that would be the case, obviously, if not about their position about remain, but the consequences of not advocating their position. whereas the Leafside SAD language was much smaller. If we look at past versus future orientation, this is partly a feature of language itself. More, any language typically shows more of a past tense than a future tense, but so these are negative. So zero is the point where you basically are breaking even, because this is the, technically speaking, this is a log ratio with some smoothing. So zero is the point where you're dead even. Anything negative means that you're more of the second than the first. So everyone's looking a little bit more to the past, but remain was looking much more to the past. Leave is looking, relatively speaking, much more to the future. Remain is looking more to the past. And then finally, there's a category for language about being tentative. Leave, much less tentative in language than the remain side. The remain side was speaking in less certain terms, where we're starting to see a pattern emerge where the language of the leave side was more about future, more about reward, less uncertain, and less sad. Finally, there's a category, there's two more categories, and then I'm done. Power language. The leave side very much stronger in terms of power language than either the neutral or the remain sides. And these are power terms about being definite, about being assertive, about taking control, about sovereignty, those sorts of things. And then there's one about quantitative language, and this is one that I would be accused of using frequently. The remain side used a lot of quantitative language. All these figures that Michael Gove didn't like from experts about the economy was more something. I mean, everyone used it a little bit, but remain used it more than leave. Thank you.
Thanks, Kenneth. Now we have the pleasure of hearing the responses, first from Professor Sarah Hobold and then from Dr. Jennifer Jackson-Preece.
Well, thank you so much, Ken, for that absolutely fascinating talk. I just wanted to sort of make three points to put it in a broader context. But first, I was reminded of what someone today in a survey company told me about big data. Said it was a bit like teenage sex, that everyone is talking about it, but not very many people are doing it. And those people who are doing it are not doing it very well. And I think we will all agree after this that Ken is obviously doing it and doing it very well. And I think it's very inspiring for researchers who are thinking, just seeing how much can really be done with these kind of data. And I guess that's where my sort of comments, what they're about, is how what are really the possibilities beyond what you've already shown us in this. And so my first point is about the fact that Twitter users, even though we have 20% of the UK population being Twitter users, obviously still a kind of very skewed sample. So I'm wondering, how does this reflect what's going on in the population in terms of a debate? It's a highly select group, and not only are most people not on Twitter, but most people on Twitter do not talk about politics. So my Twitter feed, now I've been outed, apparently I'm some like Remain campaigner. I had no idea, but that's what his algorithm has told me. So I thought I was really neutral. It's kind of embarrassing. I thought my tweets were neutral and scientific, and then I'm off the scale on the Remain side. So that's a surprise to me. But I'm kind of an outlier. If you look at my husband's Twitter account, it's all about Arsenal. So, you clearly, the kind of people who are on Twitter talking about Brexit is not normal people. They're kind of extreme in their views, but are they opinion leaders and so on? And we know with Brexit, we know with Trump, we know with the last general election that the polls who had random samples of people did not get it right. And so the question is, in a sense, could taking this big data approach have gotten us closer to the answer, even though, of course, what we know is that these are very skewed samples. So I think that's interesting. And a lot of what you found, of course, resonates with the analysis I've done of the campaign using very different methods. So you do this sort of positivity you find versus the negativity. I mean, that's also when you analyze the campaign rhetoric. The past versus the future. It's interesting there that the Leave campaign, clearly, they talk to the future. But if you look at survey research of Leavers, the best predictor in terms of attitude is actually nostalgia. So, yeah, they talk about the future, but it's kind of you know, taking back control to go back. So for people who thought the country was better the way it used to be, that's a really very powerful predictor of whether or not you voted leave or remain. But I just think in terms of whether we can go beyond sort of analyzing, obviously, events and intensity, you know, could we have seen that there was a mobilizing force, a positive force behind the leave campaign that wasn't there in the remain campaign? The second point I want to make, which Ken also alluded to, is, and which is really also alluded to in the title of this talk, is whether what does that do to the nature of our democracy? So I know it's a big question, but there's a lot of talk of these echo chambers, that when we open our Twitter feeds or our Facebook, social media, if you opened it, now you all know where apparently I am on this Remain-Leave spectrum. So you will also therefore know that when I opened Twitter and Facebook on the 24th of June, all I got was like, oh, this is terrible. This is the end of the world. But of course, for other people who opened their Twitter feeds and Facebook, they would have gotten, you know, this is wonderful, this is great, we've taken back control. So we live in these echo chambers where people tell us what we want to hear and it reinforces it. And again, what can big data tell us about that? You showed that these communities don't really overlap. So what does that do to our democratic discussion, the fact we can't talk with each other, that we only hear the things we want to hear? Now I do, for example, now follow Donald Trump, and that he doesn't always tell me what I want to hear, but it does make me very anxious. So you can see by unfollowing people who you don't agree with, that makes you, you know, that gives you the kind of reward, and that helps you. So you can see why psychologically it's much more comforting to just follow people who agree with you on things. And that leads me to the final points, which is perhaps the impression you could have from this talk is that people had really fixed attitudes towards Remain and Leave us when they went into that campaign. And for most people, perhaps not all of those on Twitter, but for most citizens, that was not the case. I mean, people didn't really have such strong views. But what has happened, when we look at public opinion research, is that these attitudes, whether you're a Remainer or a Leaver, have become increasingly solidified and have even sort of been a kind of group identity that now shapes how we look at other issues. And I find that fascinating also to the extent to which you can then use Twitter. Now you can classify people's like Leaver and Remainer. Does that then also shape how you think of other things? The reason the court judgments this week is a good example, you know, it was very much seen as like if you were on the Leave side, then you clearly had to be against that because it gave power to Parliament or any other way, or you had to support it. And so that's what we find in experimental research on public opinion is that now your identity in the campaign, what you voted on the 23rd of June, shapes your attitudes towards a lot of other things. So in other words, that Twitter helps create these social ties, but also these opinion-based groups where before we had these social group identity to do with our class or other things, but now we also have them around political opinion and Twitter helps create that. So these were just some food for thought, and I'm sure the audience will follow up on some of these. Thank you.
Dr. Jennifer Jackson, please.
Thank you. And like Sarah, I was absolutely fascinated by the findings as well. Before I say anything, I should reveal two things about myself. My name is Jennifer, and I am a bit of a Twitter nerd, so you can take what I say with a grain of salt from that direction. But equally, I have no mathematical abilities whatsoever, and to excuse this fact, I call myself a qualitative researcher, so much of what I'm going to say is focusing on the words bit. Thank goodness for word bubbles in trying to understand the information that I was given. When I was looking at this, sort of the first big take-home message that I get from it, and I think this is its significance in so many respects, it walks us through the landscape of Twitter in a really effective way. And obviously when we do want to try and understand what happened with Brexit, equally what happened later with Trump and the United States election, and I want to come back to that, there is a deluge of evidence, and having someone there who has begun to make sense of the whole of it, 26 million tweets in its entirety, is extremely useful. And it's extremely useful not just for those who are into big, big data, but equally for people like myself who are interested in words and therefore a lot smaller data. I only have 100,000 tweets, so you know clearly I can't compare. But it's nice to see that actually what I look at in a qualitative way is very similar to what Ken has found in a big picture, qualitative or quantitative, pardon me, sort of way. So the key features which really spoke to me, first of all, the issue of boundaries between groups. As somebody, of course, who studies nationalism, I'm very interested in the boundaries between groups. And when I look to Twitter data, what I'm interested in wanting to understand more fully is emerging social boundaries, the distances between groups, whether they're getting bigger, whether they're getting smaller, are they brightening, are they blurring? And so seeing some of that come through in this data was most evocative. And I think trying to understand what has happened now as between the Leave and the Remain cleavages is also incredibly important. When I look at my very small amount of data, one of the things that I see is quite interesting, and I think, again, it resonates very much with what Ken has seen, so I'd be interested in his comments on this. If you look at hashtags, and I only look at hashtags, remember I'm a word person, so the word and the hashtag for me becomes significant as an ongoing conversation. What I find, interestingly, is that the Leave-associated hashtags, the ones Ken has already flagged to you, are something like 98% Leave content only, and the Remain hashtags are something like 75% Remain only hashtags. Now, they're both obviously overwhelmingly in one direction, but the interesting thing about this is that hashtags are chosen by the user. So, in fact, it is the Remain side that does not want to be in any sense associating themselves with Leave, almost to the tune of 100%, and the Leave side that is actually more open, interestingly, to wanting to associate and entertain inside the Remain hashtag feed. So that, to me, was quite an interesting surprise, because it seems to suggest in some respects that it is actually the Remain position that is a harder position, a brighter position, than the other side, and the other side in a little bit more open, a little bit more opaque. Interesting, and to me, initially counterintuitive, but I'd be interested to hear what Ken has to say about that. The other point that struck me as quite interesting, also remember I'm interested in nationalism, is very much the echo chamber. And one of the dilemmas of the echo chamber seems to be that individuals are able to find those with whom they already agree, and then in their interactions they socialize one another to ever more extreme versions of the original starting point. So in other words, we would expect boundaries to keep getting brighter. And again, I think you saw some of this in the evidence that Ken was presenting, and it would be interesting to hear a little bit more of that. The final point which struck me, remember I'm a word person, so I loved that word bubble, is the words in the word bubble. The slides went fast, but if you can recall, and at some point if others are interested, maybe Ken will even go back to that one slide, there were three big, big words. These are the ones that were most prolific within the data sample, and the data sample is ending beginning of July, and the big words were Trump, UK, an industrial revival, three of them that really stood out. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. And that's interesting because it seems to suggest that we can, in fact, and indeed I think we should, in fact, begin to think of Brexit, what happened in the EU referendum vote here in the United Kingdom and the United States election, as similar, potentially even related phenomena in the sense that they are responding to similar events in a similar kind of way. And it seems, looking at that again, that in both cases, we have got the brightening of boundaries created as a result of changes having been brought about by globalization, by deindustrialization, by the schism emerging, of course, and we hear a lot about this, between the left behinds and the so-called elites who are doing well. And again, if you look closely at the content of the hashtags, you see a lot of that in terms of the thicker vision of values that the identities are beginning to relate to. So I think that too would be a fascinating point to come back at in Ken's final comments. And the final question, and this is to Ken and his team, in my Twitter data, there is the ordinary man endlessly, and I've been endlessly curious if this is a bot or a real person. He's one of these incredibly prolific people, and I don't know if you know, but I would love it if you did. Who knows, maybe other people have been astounded by the prolificacy of ordinary man in the data pool. He's, by the way, of course, a Vote Leave supporter. As one would suggest, it's a very popular, populistic expression of that type of identity and that type of sentiment. So, fascinating results, and really looking forward to hearing the debate that comes out of it. Thank you.
All right, we're going to open the panel to the audience. So we have a couple of stewards with a microphone, if you can wait for them to come. When you take the mic, please introduce yourself, name and affiliation, please.
Hi, Steve Schiffer is from the Journalism Department at City University. Naturally, I'll be a little bit more interested in the media side of the tweets as well. And I'm just interested whether you also looked in your corpus at what major so-called mainstream media people were referring to in their tweets, because clearly I found other research this is also quite important and quite a predictor, and particularly in the UK where there was such a polarized media, I was interested in whether you had a chance to look at that aspect of the work and if it told you anything interesting.
So we'll collect a few questions.
Yeah, we're going to take them three by three. There was someone in the back, yeah, behind.
Hi, I'm Lizzie, and I work in communications for local government. I was just wondering, considering only 20% of the UK population are on Twitter at the moment, and then the turnout for the Brexit referendum was, I think, 72%, how confident are you that this could be used in a predictive way for future referendums, future elections, that sort of thing?
And a third question in the back over there. Stuart.
Hi, I'm Denisa Kostovich from Government Department. Thank you for this presentation. I was quite bemused when media came up with a new adjective when Brexit happened, which is Brexity, Brexit with an I. And since then, media has been putting different political figures on a scale, kind of how Brexity one person is or not. So I just wondered, looking beyond Brexit Remain divide, whether your data can tell you about the differences within the Leave camp, and which basically will tell us also a lot about the legitimacy of the process coming forward, and the complexities that don't just cut across for and against. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm happy to address some of these questions so far, and maybe I'll have a chance to mention some of the things that Jennifer and Sarah also asked. The first question is about the mainstream media and are they partisan? This is actually something that we did a classification. So you we got the classification from that page about the MPs' user accounts and which party they were in, and that's what I used to make that bar plot that had the classification by party of which MPs were Remain and which were Leave and which were neutral. Very few neutral, but some in the Conservative Party. We have the same thing for media. So we actually have the accounts of most media organizations, but it was rather limited. It was very mainstream media, which has become a term of something of a term of approbation in the United States context of mainstream media versus these alternative media. Turns out there's a lot of different media. Even in the UK, there are all these websites, there are magazines, there are news channels, there are newspapers, and we didn't think it would be a very representative picture to just present the main newspapers. We could have done, but we have the potential to do that analysis. It's definitely something we want to do. I didn't have results that I thought were systematic enough to be a fair portrayal to present here. In terms of prediction, so our colleague Julio Amador at Imperial has actually been looking at an aggregate set of polls to track the Leave Remain vote intention with the proportion of Leave Remain predicted mentions and the volume of that. And while it's still not a much better predictor than the polls, it actually tracks the polls very well. So it really does follow the polls. And we're working on a paper about that, actually, that says that it's not really an alternative, but It does pick up in this case. It was pretty good. It still predicted that it was going to be almost too close to call in a statistical sense. So it wasn't a knockout blow, but it wasn't a knockout blow for the polls either. And then the last question I have was about from Denisa about the differences in the leave camp. This is a really interesting thing to look at. And one of the sets of results that I wasn't able to show you, because the computer just didn't, after 2 or 3 days, it was still trying to fit this model. There's a branch of statistical modeling that looks at clusters of language. It's called topic modeling. And it's one of the big advances in text analysis in the recent decade or so. You can take a series of text with tons of documents, and you can feed it to the machine, and it separates out what are plausible collections of terms that form what we interpret to be as topics. And what would be really interesting to do is to see what the leave topics are, and then to see the prevalence of those leave topics across the prominent leave campaigners and users. And this is where we think, you know, there's really the substance for a sort of what we call the sort of academic article, where we can really look at to see the diversity of opinions on one side versus the diversity of messages. We're really interested in what the messaging was, and that's where it gets really interesting. And unfortunately, I just don't have much beyond some hashtag collections to show you. And I mentioned this is exploratory, and you can imagine exploring, you know, it's like an ocean of tweets that we have, and exploring that is practically challenging and is computationally challenging. The way we did this, by the way, is to take a relatively small sample, the sort of sample that Jennifer was talking about. You take a few hundred thousand, which is quite manageable even on a laptop, and you fit all your analyses to this manageable set, and you hope that this is a representative sample. We did this on a subsample from June. Once you get that analysis perfected, then you try it on a bigger size, and then once that works, you try it on the entirety. But some of these procedures are exponential in their complexity, so doing something that's 10 times bigger may take some. It's not 10 times more time. It can be 1,000 times more time because of the spaces, the parameters that have to be explored. So, and I'm no expert on computational complexity, but I know that it still tied up some of our computers for days without a result. So we're working on that. We're working on moving this to some high-performance computing to get those results. But that is definitely something we're going to be working on. Should I address some of the discussant comments? Or
if you want, yes.
Just say a few things. Thank you very much for your comments, Sarah and Jennifer. Very interesting. One of the comments was about whether this is a skewed sample, right? Is 20% representative? This is one of the challenges in using this for prediction. It's probably not representative, but it may not be representative of the opinion in the population, but very often the dialogue that is taking place is representative of the discourse about Brexit. And the themes that people mention are not substantially different from the themes that people mention about Brexit more broadly. They might be slightly more skewed, and it's an interesting question for media and communications and political communications, for example. Honestly, I thought that you would find a lot more leave messages on social media, because it's an easy and inexpensive platform for people with extreme views to make themselves heard in a way that they didn't have access to before. Take the example of this unfortunate person who had the LSE at the beginning of her username that we singled out to pick on. For example, you don't get to reach thousands of people if you're that sort of person. You only reach the people down at the local bar who are drowning their sorrows in some cheap wine, but with social media, you can reach a platform, global platform, of anyone who wants to look at that. And I thought there'd be more of that, and it didn't appear that there was. There is some very interesting stuff to drill down in this issue of the dynamics of groups and the boundaries of groups. And this issue of the echo chamber is a really, really important one, because it suggests that rather than becoming a tool for communication, rather than becoming a tool to enlighten our citizenry, it's possible that electronic communication and information systems are reinforcing cliques of people who are like-minded. So rather than broadening ourselves, we're resisting that and forming echo chambers where we only talk to people that are just like us. And the platforms not only enable this, they actually actively create that. Facebook will actively, you know, whenever you log into a social media platform, it does its best to recommend things that it thinks that you're going to like. And it wants to keep you happy so that you keep going back and reading advertisements on the platform. So it's very actively part of the technology to reinforce this echo chamber. And do I think this is a reason for concern? I don't know the full extent of it yet. We're still studying that. But the answer is yes, I do think this is a really big reason for concern. And when people start to associate that when the boundary between opinion and facts starts to blur, and we take our main source of news and facts as something from a social media feed, for democracy, that can be a fatal problem.
Fantastic. Let's take three more questions. We had one question over here.
Hi, thank you very much. My name's James from the City University of New York. I'm also, like Dr. Jackson Priest, very interested in the boundaries between groups and constructions of group identity. And I was wondering how you decided upon the boundaries between the neutral category and remain and leave as it goes sort of across that spectrum. I guess particularly the neutral stands out to me as something I'm quite interested in further exploring.
Mm-hmm. The lady in the back.
Hi, I'm international relations alumni at the LSE here. I'm curious, looking towards the future, are you going to continue doing this research as kind of the discussion on Twitter moves towards the negotiations? And how you think that, I mean, the fact that it is going to be constantly analyzed on the Twitter sphere will affect the negotiations or is already affecting the pre-negotiation phase?
One gentleman over there, yeah.
Good afternoon, everyone. The question that I would like to ask is, if we think that this 20% of the UK's population is using social media, and we could say that if this 20% does actually represent the population, to what extent would the role of social media have actually played in Brexit actually happening, with the Leave comments, as well as the Remain comments, as well as the neutral comments, and making Brexit happen?
Okay, three good questions, or actually ones I think I can answer pretty directly and shortly. How did we classify the neutrals? This was done on a very technical criterion, which comes from the classifier that we use comes up with a predicted probability of you being in the way that we pitched it was the probability that you're a pro-Remain. So that's why the LSE accounts and my account and Sarah's account were all on the right side. Jennifer, I wish I'd included you. The probability is from 0 to 1, and a probability of 0.5 would mean it's basically a coin toss as to whether you're Leave or Remain, and we set the decision boundaries at basically 0.2 and 0.8. So if your probability of being Remain was 0.2, it means that you're more than 1 in 5 likely to be Leave. And if it was above 0.8, it means you're more than 1 in 5 likely to be Remain. And anything in the middle, we just called that neutral. Now, is that substantively neutral? It means in the sense of our classifier that you are as likely to mention something about neutrality, about leaving as remaining. So it could be very well a mixture. But it's an interesting question. Is there a difference between someone who mentions a lot of Leave stuff and a lot of Remain stuff and it balances each other out? Or you just mention a bunch of stuff in the middle that really is neutral, like a news agency should, but not necessarily would. The second question was about negotiations. Are we continuing to gather the information for the negotiations? Yes, we're capturing tweets right now. It takes a while to filter down into our database. We have to get these downloaded from their database. We have to process them. We have to then reformat them and put them into our database because this is not the sort of thing, you know, we're not talking about a spreadsheet that gets emailed here. We're talking, you know, we're talking about huge, huge quantity of data that has to be parceled up in pieces. And will I think this affect the negotiations? If I did, I would manipulate it as much as possible. But no, I don't think that it will. Outside of, will the tweets about it affect the negotiations? I still think, and maybe this is a question for Jean-Christophe's area of expertise, but my feeling is that the media and the things that are reported still are the effects of fundamental things going on, the way of communicating that rather than actually creating them. Sometimes a news story does become its own story. So I may have this wrong now. I mean, Donald Trump seems to understand this better than anyone. His tweets are, when I read the New York Times each day, his tweets are always in a story about the New York Times. They're like these little indented quotes where they have entire stories about what he's tweeted. And what he says causes the news. People who don't know Twitter are reading Twitter through traditional news outlets. And it's definitely affecting things. I mean, just ask the mainland Chinese what they think when he tweets about Taiwan. It's definitely causing things to happen. Last question was about what role the 20% of the users in the UK are using Twitter. So what role do we think that this plays? I think it was a question about what role it plays in the overall shaping the discussions. It's an interesting question as to how much campaigning you can actually do through social media. And it's very, very difficult. The central problem, in my view, of media studies is how do we design a truly honest study where we can say that the media, as a medium for communicating events, actually shapes those events. The problem is that media is designed to react to events. So when we see the correlation between something happening and something being reported, it's extremely difficult to isolate how much of that is caused by the reporting, but how much of these two things are just coming from the event itself. So a tornado wipes out part of the southern United States. The media didn't cause that, right? The media reported on that. But when some sort of scandal happens that is about basically people's perception and what they think are happening, that can very often be caused by a leak in the press as a causal event. I don't think that those were the fundamental drivers of attitudes and actions on Brexit, but I do think that there is this element of the echo chamber, especially in as much as it relates to people's perception of facts. Mm-hmm. And when we have people through the media telling us to discount the facts as presented by experts, you know, who do you trust to give you an assessment of the projected economic impact of leaving the European Union? Well, I would trust economists. I trust my colleagues over in the economics department here at the LSE. But there was, Michael Gove is a leader of the Brexit campaign, basically said we're sick of listening to the skeptic experts and discounting the expertise. And people who receive that message would be more inclined to interpret those facts in an alternative way. And I think the extreme version of this we're seeing among some of Trump's followers. Some of the studies that are coming out now are showing that people, the way that people interpret facts and the reporting of news is very, very different depending on your prior beliefs.
Fantastic. Let's take three more questions. We have a gentleman over there.
Hi, thanks for the research. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I'm really interested to know, you talk about wanting to, or your sort of problem is trying to sort of understand what's going on in this ocean of information. And I almost think about it as being, well, actually, you don't really want to understand the ocean. You really want to understand the current. There's going to be sections or pools of things in this ocean that are going to be moving around. So if that's kind of the thing you're trying to understand, what is it in sort of 3 to 5 years you hope your research is going to achieve? Because you're spending a lot of time, a lot of money trying to achieve something. What is it?
There's a gentleman in the middle of the crowd over there. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask that, do you think by eradicating social media, the result would have been different off the vote? Thank you.
And a third over here.
I'm Chris. I work for an international development NGO. And I have sort of two linked questions. First of all, what does the data show, if anything, regarding the sort of more dubious claims, specifically $350 million to the NHS? And secondly, was there any evidence of deliberation? Did people change their minds, or were you not able to tell that?
Thank you very much. So should we be looking at the trees rather than trying to capture the forest, or if we want to use the ocean metaphor? So we are very much interested in the currents and the topography of specific parts, right? But finding that in an ocean is not an easy thing. I think that was the main point. What do we want to find, basically, once we're done with this analysis? I think two really important things. I think this notion of looking at how messages are conveyed and the communities that people communicate to and from one another through is really interesting, this notion of this echo chamber. And I do think that that is a concern for democracy, which relies on the free flow of information. Is it still flowing freely? How are people receiving it? And I also think that finding out something about what I wasn't really able to show you in the detail that I'd hoped, about the content of the messages, what sort of messages are being, what is the discourse on each side? What are things that themes that people are focusing on? Because this helps us to understand this phenomenon known as populism. And it's a problem for elites. You know, and what you can say, you know, we are LSE professors, we're a type of elite. You know, we talk to each other. We don't talk to the sort of people who, in somewhere in the Midlands, lost their job in a factory and they felt unhappy and they voted for Brexit. It's hard for us, it's hard for people in Westminster to understand this. For us to understand that dialogue, we want to look at the sources we can. I think social media is a good source of that. And we want to characterize that where we can find it. It's not that we think that this is necessarily the best forum, but we just can't go do ethnographic research in all the different forums and communities across the UK, but we can actually get the entire ocean content, at least through Twitter. It may not be representative, but we hope that the elements of that debate are all present in some fashion. Very interesting second question. Would it have been a different or preferable outcome if we could eradicate social media? How many of you have ever asked yourselves, you know, would life be better if we could eradicate social media? Some of us can remember what life was like before there was social media. People actually talked to one another. social media is supposed to be a way to talk to one another. And the interesting question is that what it is, or are we just talking to, you know, who are we talking to? Are the highest tweeters in our sample weren't even human beings. Are you sure that some of the content that you're being fed is not a computer-generated algorithm? This thing called the Turing test, you know, can you distinguish a computer from a human being? It's getting harder and harder. And most people wouldn't even try. They don't even care whether it's a human being or an algorithm. So that's a question we could speculate deeply on in a philosophical sense. I don't have any way of knowing that, of course. And then the last question about could we investigate, there's two elements, I think. Could we investigate claims about the veracity of things like the 350 million, not through social media? Did it change people's minds? Now, that's a really interesting question that's related to the echo chamber. We can track what people are saying over time, and we haven't in our analysis. We just grouped every tweet that was sent by a particular user, but to look at the evolution of those attitudes, if we could drill down to that, that would be really interesting. It would also be really interesting to try to cluster people by some external information that's part of their user account, like where they're from, what region of the country they're from. Maybe there's some information that's harder to get, but information about their gender, which you can classify from the information, the metadata about their user. Sometimes there's demographic information in there. Unfortunately, it's not all direct information. So if someone has a description of their, you know, user, you know, LSE professor, like Arsenal, and golf, you know, you got some information in there about your preferences, that you know that you're male, you know that your profession, you know where you live, you know, Surrey mom who loves baking, that sort of thing. These are people's profiles, but it's not so systematic. Other times people don't put anything or it's not descriptive. We wish we had more information. If it were a traditional survey, we'd have that information, but we often don't. And more people, you should all turn on your geolocations on your devices. So if you're tweeting, it would be really helpful if we could get more accurate information about your precise location at all times, please. Only about 3% of tweets are geocoded.
But your map was good, given that. Except Cornwall, which you got wrong.
The map is the location of the internet service providers. So you get those big blocky clusters because those are all people who are going through the same
Virgin Relay or whatever.
Okay. As a follow-up to the last question, I was curious, could you see or are you interested in seeing characteristics in terms of rhetorical strategies? Like you mentioned, one side was using more quantified elements, we can assume to make a point. Could you extrapolate it on that and see more like, for example, specific behaviors on each side? Like one side is like engaging in aggressive or trolling or obfuscation of discussion type of strategies than the other. Is that of interest?
It's of great interest. That's a very good suggestion. And after doing the quantitative language analysis, I realized that one of the things we'd done in pre-processing the language was to remove all numerals. Like, so if you had to, you know, 1 million, if that was an actual term, we removed it. And we could have, you know, here we are categorizing adjectives that refer to quantitative concepts, but we actually removed the quantities themselves. That was kind of daft. Fortunately, this is all computer programs, so we can find these things that we've done, and we can go back, we can modify, we can rerun it, we can reproduce this analysis after tweaking it. And that's the way this sort of data exploration works. There is a lot of retracing the steps. The computer doesn't mind. But looking, drilling down into the rhetorical strategies, I think that's a great idea, and that's something that we plan to do.
Mm-hmm. Great. More questions? Lady over there.
Hi, my name's Stacey. I was wondering if you could share your thoughts or comments on fake news stories, which are becoming quite popular at the moment. I think the most, there was quite a famous one with the young Donald Trump saying, if I was to run, I'd run Republican because they're so dumb, they believe anything on Fox News, which he didn't actually say. And so much fake news is now being shared on social media, and there are so many people that get their news sources just from social media. So I was wondering if you felt that had an effect on Brexit and with the election as well.
I don't have any knowledge or evidence of my own that it had an effect on Brexit. Here's a way you could study that, though, and it's a really interesting phenomenon. So on one of the ways that these fake news stories would sink like a stone instantly if it weren't for social media. What allows people to spread them are, and this is the way that you start a fake news story, is you write it, and then you go on social media and you post it all over the place. And once you get it injected into these little self-replicating circles, people start sharing it around and it takes off. And you can read about these stories of people who admit that they've done fake news. This is exactly how they do it. So you can look for the evidence of this on things like Facebook and Twitter. Facebook is a little bit harder to examine because you only have access to the people who are in your circle of friends or sometimes their friends. You can look at public posts, though. Public pages allow people to post on them, and those you can actually get. They're in the public domain. I think an interesting research design strategy for investigating this question would be to look at all the shares of news stories. And when you looked into those shares, to have some separate algorithm that enabled you to classify them according to whether they were from sources we would trust, like the Times, or whether they were from some obscure website that would be likely to be fake news. And if you looked at the number of times those posts were shared and who they were shared among, you would have a good way to get a grip on how widely circulated fake news was. So if you're interested in doing a PhD, I've just given you a great idea for doing a PhD, I think.
We have time for one last question. Yes, in the middle. The microphone is coming.
You said that it's a shame that you don't know the gender of the people. How is gender going to affect the results of the debate or discussion? Like, why is gender important?
I agree. It is a shame, and I wish this information, there should be some checkbox you have to put on your profile to indicate whether you're male or female or whatever gender classification you want, because that would be something that we really could use for analysis. The way that the platform that we got the information from, when it vastly overrepresents, I don't believe that it's just, you know, 85% males who are sending these tweets, but they have some patterns which are basically reinforcing stereotypes, because they've assumed from whatever system they've trained it on, and it could be anything, that the certain language that you use and indications about your profile, and using some algorithm that we don't even know, they're able to basically say that this is a tweet from a male or female. So they probably classified the bot that sent the 85,000 tweets as male, for example, right? So in some cases, it's not even a human that has a gender. We don't use that information because we don't trust it. And we don't want to use information that is not either, I mean, the essence of social science as an activity means that the methods are open and transparent and can be reproduced. We don't use proprietary things from companies that we don't trust them if we don't know how they work. So everything that we did in analysis, we know how it works because we did it original analysis. We programmed that down to the wire to do everything that I've showed you today. So the challenge, it's not a question that we wouldn't prefer to do that. The practical challenge is, how do you get reliable information about the gender of someone sending a message?
We're going to have to stop on that note, but thank you all very much for coming tonight. We hope to see you soon at the next LSE Works and LSE Public Event. Thank you.